You know, through the years, I've seen people make relocation decisions all the time, and almost none of them say, I'm moving because there's an astounding church there. In most cases, they haven't even investigated.
Hello, and welcome to Working with me, Dan Doriani, hosting a podcast where we explore faith, work, culture, and the way believers can make a difference in their corner of the world. My guest today is Ray Cortez, a self-professed unspiritual pastor who has spent 40 years in the same small town church. It's a large church, but I did come into this interview hoping to hear from Ray, what does it take to endure and serve faithfully in a small town? Instead, I heard a candid testimony about the way God reshapes ambition for his own purposes. So my guest today is Ray Cortez. And he is a pastor of a large church on the West Coast, the Gulf Coast of Florida. He started that church in 1983 by himself, solo church planter with 12 people. And today that church has about 2,000 people who would say, this is my home church. There's also a school. There's also a camp that has lots of kids in the summer. I think it's not a total exaggeration to say that Ray, you play the role of something akin to a pope or bishop in Citrus County. I mean, your church is one of the biggest churches in the area. You're an influential person. People look to you for guidance. And I know it makes you uncomfortable to hear that sort of thing, but first of all, it's a delight to have you. I've always enjoyed talking to you. Can you just give us a little story of the church, the community, and why you've been there for 39 years of blessed ministry?
Sure. Yeah, the idea that I'm a papal authority in the community when I don't have it in my own home. So, yeah, my wife might have vomited
Yeah, but a prophet has no honor in his own country. Yeah. So the people who run the barbershop may have a higher opinion of you than your children do, right?
Yes, I was going to say the only one who would have gotten more ill would have been my four children.
Right.
But anyway, yeah, I came here. I grew up in Miami. Came here, got married, went to college, met my wife there. Got married, decided to go to graduate school. I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. I wanted to work with people. I was going to be a lawyer, politician, teacher, coach, counselor, and kind of decided maybe pastor would be a combination of all the above. Only problem was I wasn't that spiritual, and honestly, I'm still not. And that's not like trying to be humorous or funny. It just is. Yeah. And so graduated from school in Miami, actually, graduate school, and couldn't find a calling. And I networked everywhere I could and nothing, just crickets. And I was doing a wedding in Orlando. My brother was actually getting married and I was helping officiate. And the pastor there said, I got this little thing happened, this place called Citrus County, Florida.
Yes.
A little group that's meeting in a place called Homo Sassa. I'd never heard. I lived in Florida virtually all my life, never heard of it. So he said, well, you go over there and be interested. I said, I'm not the least bit interested. My wife's from Chicago. I'm from Miami. We actually want to go where people live. And I don't want to live in a small rural town. I want to, you know, I want to impact people. But I said, I'll go preach there. I need experience. So anyway, we came. It was a horrible visit. I didn't want to come here. I really had no interest. You know, tell it was a pretty little, quaint little place. They offered me the job. I kept putting them off, praying like crazy, nothing. And finally it was like, well, you know, I'm 25 years old. I've got any offers. I don't want to do youth ministry. I don't like teenagers. They don't like me. So, hey, at least I'll learn the ministry. Maybe in 3 or 4 years, I can get out of that little backwater town and go do something meaningful with my life. So I said, yes. And I'm not kidding, Dan. The phone rang off the hook after that.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah.
With job offers. But right. Here I was committed to come. So came in 1983. We met in a little middle school, I didn't understand that the church didn't have any support. I was too stupid to ask the right questions.
Can I just stop right now? This may be, you've said about five reasons why we connect. So first of all, I was a youth pastor for about 2 weeks once. It was actually about 18 months. And I honestly believe that the junior high side, the senior high side went better. But the junior high side, I think they came in order to torment me. I think that was their goal. And they succeeded. And then you made the comment that pastors, you're not very spiritual. And that's probably a statement a number of pastors could make. You're the kind of guy that actually says that. What on earth do you mean when you say you're not very spiritual? I just have to go back to that. What does that mean?
You know, I just, I don't really love to read theology and deep stuff. And
you like to read politics. You're like a lay politician.
I do probably enjoy that more. And I feel like in some ways I'm more of an organizational leader. I have more leadership gifts than I'm really a spiritual leader. And that's, you know, kind of not necessarily a good thing when they call you preacher. So
yeah, but I've got to just jump in and say, you're a very good preacher. I've heard you preach. You're a good communicator. And I think one of the things that makes somebody a good communicator is wide knowledge, which you certainly have, right? You know, I don't know if you ever saw the studies that show that the papers, the theological papers, academic papers, anthropology, physics, you know, biology, epidemiology, you name it, that draw from all kinds of sources and not just from within their own field are the ones that get cited a lot more.
How about that?
They have a hard time getting published, but once they're published, drawing on disparate fields makes people find more creativity.
Well, I was a history and political science major, and that came through good advice. People said, well, if you go to graduate school, go to seminary,
right,
you'll get tons of Bible and theology. So do something else before you go there.
Yeah. So I'm disavowing your claim that you don't like to read theology. I'm repackaging it as an assertion that you have diverse interests. And I'm not going to let you disagree too much with that.
Okay.
But I want to come back. I want to make sure we label that you said you didn't want to be in a small town because you wanted to make an impact. And of course, what's happened is you stayed in a small town. I'm going to invite you to keep telling your story with this in mind. And you had an enormous impact.
Yeah, certainly didn't roll out the way I thought. And you asked, you know, what's led this long tenure and one place that I didn't intend to stand. I mean, honestly, my wife loves to shop. Again, she's from Chicago. We were in Miami before we came here. It's like an epic shopping city. And it's just filled with life and food and cultural diversity. And this is just a wasteland, to be honest. Beautiful community, beautiful springs and lakes and right on the Gulf. And
you can swim with the manatees.
Yes. And which is very attractive worldwide now. People come here from all over the world. But at the time, that was an undiscovered delight. So, yeah, I didn't intend to. But why did we? Well, you know, something happened one of the first years we were here that I went to a conference somewhere. And one of my seminary professors, Richard Watson was his name.
Yes.
Said, why don't you do your kid, just an offhand comment, he said, why don't you do your kids a favor and let them grow up in one place?
Yeah.
And I never had a vision for that. Mm-hmm. But that's what I experienced as a child. And I had an idyllic view of my childhood. And I thought, well, why not? You know, and the idea that if my family's flourishing here, why would I move? And they seemed to be. And so why would I change jobs? And what did I think that a different community or a different experience or different pastorate was really going to fill in my life that wasn't happening here?
And the church was growing, people respecting your ministry.
The church was fruitful. So again, I was really loved and supported. Again, I didn't know when I started. I mean, the church had no outside support, this little group.
Right.
The presbytery had no interest in it. The PCA barely had any interest in it. There was a $5,000 in the bank when I got here.
Yes.
And I didn't realize till I started that, you know, my take-home salary is $18,000. And I didn't realize that they couldn't even pay that.
I'm just going to stop again. So the first, I did a church revitalization. And the first week I was there were 21 people. And our income the first month was $1,200. And there was essentially nothing in the bank. And my salary was lesser by, you know, it was $15,000. Of course, that was in
1684. Oh, so we're going to play that game, aren't
we? Yeah, we're going to play that game. Well, it was 1684, so money used to go farther in those days. But no, I think it was a couple years earlier, so it was probably fundamentally identical to what you had. And I also had no idea that you were supposed to ask questions about budgets. And those were times when, you know, five people said, I have a vision for a church. People just said, yeah, sure, go ahead. Knock yourself out. And if it works, it works. And if it doesn't, you can become a youth pastor.
Right. That's right. Yeah.
So God blessed, and the church grew, and your kids flourished in one place.
You know, again, it wasn't, it had its moments. You know, the first day I was here, I came on a Saturday night, preached on the Sunday morning to this little group that was actually meeting, even though there were, you know, 10, 12, 15 of them. And walking out to my car afterwards, one of the only young people in the group walked up to me, about a 25-year-old guy, and said, I just want you to know that I hate you.
Oh, goodness.
I went there 24 hours. And he said, I was opposed to you. I voted against, you know, us offering you the job. I just want to be honest with you about that. And I remember driving home thinking, honestly, that's got to be the best thing that could ever have happened, because if I went into this gig thinking this was going to be a career where you get lauded and patted on the back,
yes.
I was disabused of that notion in the first day I worked here. So,
well, it's extremely healthful, I think, to get a jolt like that. You know, you could think, I'm not saying you did, but you could think, well, I mean, I've got some abilities, which you do, and they've only got 12 people. They're going to be just thrilled to get me. And no, they're not thrilled to get you. They're like, you know, I hate you. Everything you say reminds me of something. I had a woman who came to me once when I was a pastor the second time in a larger church. And she said, we were working in the kitchen side by side. And I knew she had a thing that she didn't like me. But I also felt that she was warming up somehow or other. And so I just worked beside her cleaning dishes. And after a while, she said to me, you know, Dan, I just want you to know one thing. When I joined this church because I hated you. She said, I don't know why I hated you. I had no reason to hate you, but I hated you. And that's why I joined this church, to be in a church where I hated the pastor.
Glad to be in service, ma'am.
And she said, I just want you to know I don't hate you anymore. And, you know, I like your wife. And kind of like you a little. Okay, great. I mean, I knew something was going on, but it is bizarre how the church does not always receive its pastors with warm arms.
Yeah, you get some sweet compliments just like that. A woman came out not a couple weeks ago, and she said, wow, that was a great sermon. I mean, that is the Ray Cortez I remember we had years ago.
Oh, no.
Oh, well,
We could probably trade bizarre things people said to us over the years. But anyway, the Lord did bless, and you have persevered.
You know, it was fruitful. Like I said, people loved us so well. You know, one of the founders of the church was a physician. And I'm not kidding. When I would preach week after week, I would come out, and he would be crying. And he would say to me, that's the best sermon I've ever heard. And I would think, wait a minute, you said that last week and the week before that. And he meant it. I mean, so I also think, to be honest, probably I stayed a long time for insecurity. You know, if you have a gig that's working, I'm not sure I was secure enough in, or even got the gospel in a way that, you know, failure, the fear of failure probably kept me to something that was working. Mm. I also, along the way, I realized my thirst for prominence was a good thing to push back against.
Mm-hmm.
And we live in the day, certainly more recently, where anybody in a prominent pulpit with a lot of people doesn't seem to be faring very well.
So let me back up. We understand the thirst for prominence being dangerous, but I just love to pick up on your little throwaways. And one of your throwaways is, I'm not sure I got the gospel. Of course, you understood the gospel of substitutionary atonement, Jesus' sacrifice for sins. You were a theologian, well-trained and a credentialed person. But in what sense did you not get the gospel? Would you just tell our listeners what that means?
Well, sure. I understood Christ died for me. I grew up with that and was deeply grateful for that. And what that meant was that then you ought to go out and live as earnestly as possible for him. You know, he's looking for a few good men. He's looking for Marines, you know. And I want a church where we're going to take the hill. You know, yep. I don't want namby-pamby North American style Christians. And
right.
What I didn't understand was imputed righteousness.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd still say after 40 years in ministry, I asked every person who comes to our inquirers class, new members class, you know, the old EE question, what would you say to God if you were mm-hmm. to die and stand at the gates of heaven? He would say, why should I let you into heaven? What would you say? And I can tell you after 40 years, nobody ever says, because I'm covered with the righteousness of Christ.
Nobody ever said that.
I want to say it's 1 in 100 at
yeah,
best.
Yeah. Right.
In 40 years, it's always Christ has taken my sins away. Christ.
Okay. Yep. Right.
If they give the Christian answer, I mean, half
It's the negative, not the positive. It's my sins are gone, not also I am righteous in Christ. And that of course is enslaving.
Yeah. If your debts are gone, you still have nothing. You got to go out and produce. You got to produce. So, you know, I didn't get the gospel. And one thing I know looking back is that legalistic drivenness actually attracts a crowd. And I created a very self-righteous, Republican, right-wing, proud, we're better than the lost, the broken, the liberals, the sexually broken. And meanwhile, of course, my wife was withering under my self-righteousness. My children mm-hmm. weren't thriving. And I had a pretty exhausted group of people in the congregation. I did harm a lot of people.
Mm. Well, it's important to recognize that our best efforts are sometimes not constructive. We think we're telling the truth and we're telling some portion of it instead of the whole story and not putting it in the right context, obviously.
I had to realize I was really in ministry and driven to build a church and a school and all those things for self-validation,
mm-hmm.
to hear well done, good and faithful servant.
This podcast is a production of the Center of Faith and Work in partnership with the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals. If you're enjoying this conversation, you know the drill. Please rate this podcast and subscribe to it. And visit our workingwithdan.org site to get updates on new episodes, explore old episodes, hear clips from lectures on work, and enter to win our giveaways. You may have noticed that Ray has a penchant for self-deprecation, but he raises a good question. What is the difference between pride or arrogance and godly ambition? I hope we agree that selfish ambition is a vice, but Isaiah 32 says the noble plan noble things, and on noble things the noble stand. Let's hear what Ray has to say about that. I read one theologian, so I actually do read theology, Ray, even if you don't. One theologian that I profited from immensely said there are two kinds of love of God. There is accepting love and there's transforming love. And you need them both. God accepts us as we are, but he loves us too much to leave us as we are. He also wants us to become more like him. But you have to have accepting love first, and then you can talk about transforming love. And I just want to say I agree with you. And of course, that legalistic thrust is bound up in a lot of us. You're not saying you've defeated it. I don't hear you saying that. I hear you say you recognize that you're making progress. I find it to be a regular struggle. I mean, I find myself going off in the direction of self-validation, proving myself, demonstrating my worth with remarkable alacrity and frequency still.
Yeah, I think that I can lay my head in the pillow at night and rest in believing that God's delighted in me as his child. He's gotten a kick out of watching me flounder around during the day, just like we watch our little four-year-old on the soccer field, you know,
right,
scoring goals for the wrong team.
And thrusting their hands in the air.
Yeah, I always still love our kids. We just think they're the cutest thing. And yet when I wake up in the morning, my feet hit the floor, that all that security and gospel's leaked out overnight. My first thought is go produce, go drive away the demons of self-doubt.
Some people probably flip it, you know. I think some people go to bed frustrated with all that they didn't accomplish, and they wake up, and I'm not being coy, but, you know, they wake up and maybe read the Bible. You and I have a friend, Scotty Smith, who sends out a morning devotional, which I read lots of times, and it's just a gospel burst. So maybe I'm the opposite of you. I start off well and then wither as the day goes by, like the gourd that gave shade to Jonah slowly falls apart.
Sure. I think that the default mechanism in me is gotta hustle.
Right.
Gotta go. Gotta cover your shame.
So let me press in on this a little bit. If you had left your town, I'm interested in your perseverance, even if the motives are imperfect. And let's face it, nobody has perfect motives about anything, right?
Sure.
But let's say your motives were imperfect, but not, you know, fundamentally evil. I mean, you did want to serve God and and shepherd people and preach the gospel and raise up disciples. At some point, you started to be more gospel-driven and not just, Jesus saved me, now I can get to work, which is maybe the way you and I both heard it at first. Or look at what all God did for you, now it's time for you to do a whole bunch of stuff for God. We've been gospel-driven throughout. What year, you've been there just about 40 years, what year did you start to motivate people, motivate yourself, center on the gospel?
Yeah, I'd say it was somewhere around the 10th, 11th year. And, you know, it was life transforming. I almost felt like, I remember before that often counseling people and hearing their woes, and I'd, you know, pray with them, or I'd give them a book, you know, but I almost felt like it was just powerless. It was like, in the end, I felt like all I really had for them was, you know, you need more Jesus. So pray more, read the Bible more, go to a small group more, you know. Gosh, now I felt like I had life to offer them. I had freedom. I felt like I was converted. Now, I was a Christian before that, but it felt like a whole new life. And I wanted other people to have it too.
That's terrific. I've been at your church a couple times. It seems like a lively, healthy place. And you also have a lot of interest in giving that life to other people. So I'm not denying for a second that your church was maybe very educated, professional, achieving, Republican, et cetera. But it's not a right-wing Republican achievement-driven church now. And your school, for example, I happen to know, is extremely diverse. And, you know, your county is not a prosperous county. It's not a center of finance or law or education or medicine. It's ordinary people and ordinary jobs, right?
Yeah, and it's true. The gospel changed our church much faster than it changed me.
Yes, okay, good.
You know, in terms of, you know, the homeless shelter comes to worship. We have it's not a Christian program, but there's a major housing of handicapped adults in our community, and they come here on weekends. You know, Celebrate Recovery and AA people flooded into the church, and you know, it's like we've often heard, when older brothers actually start to get converted, younger brothers, you know, want to come see what in the world's happening. And honestly, you know, being the classic older brother Pharisee type, I'm way more comfortable with well-to-do, put together people. And so like our church is way ahead of me in terms of welcoming, warm, caring, engaging the community, loving anybody who walks through the door. I'm still learning from them.
Well, it's true. One of the things we have to do as pastors is recognize our prejudices, right?
Right.
So, you know, people, I'll just use an extreme. You know, sometimes people say to me, well, you know, you're an Anglo or European, which I'm not exactly, but all Europeans and Anglos are prejudiced. And I say, yeah, but, you know, it might not be what you think. I grew up in a Anglo minority community and, you know, played sports and so forth. I'm not saying I'm without ethnic prejudice, but that's not my main problem. And this is not my confessional, but you have to know what your prejudices are. And it could be people with bad teeth. It could be people that don't smell good. It could be people who, you know, are prone to lots of grammatical errors. And those are prejudicial as well, and failures of love.
No, I mean, you know, Jesus amazes me because, you know, the Bible just confronts constantly. You know, I drop a guest list of who I want in the eternal party, you know, in the great feast, and he throws out my guest list. He's got a whole different group of people.
Right.
Wait a minute. This is like, you know, I don't even know if I want to go to your party.
Exactly. That's exactly the problem with the party with the prodigal son, with the first son. It's like, it's a party, but I don't like the people who are in the party.
Yeah, yeah.
This is so, no good. I'm not going to go into those people.
It's been fun to see God, you know, do that at the church.
But tell me about the school a bit, because the school is connected to your church. It's, I guess, your school. But it's not really your school. It's got people from all over your community.
There's a unique bond between the church and the school. I mean, it is the same corporation. The headmaster answers to the senior pastor. We collaborate. Pretty much any accrediting group that comes here or anything always recognizes that they've never seen anything like it in terms of the connection between church and school.
Meaning tight, close, and healthy.
Yes. About 10, 15 years, 10, 12, 13 years ago, we shifted from a covenant school model where one parent had to be a professing Christian attending a local church for their kids to go here. But we had already morphed from that. Problem was, we had so many people who were professing Christians that came, and their culture was so different than ours that they were the worst parts of our school and the worst critics and the worst, you know, made Christianity so unattractive. And we had unbelievers come, and they loved it, and they, you know, they were delightful, and some of them were even converted. But we also didn't like the way it affected our faculty. There was almost a scolding, like, you kids are Christians. You're from Christian homes. You should act like it. You should, it's an assumption that you're, and we really wanted our faculty to become more persuasive, you know, the beauty of Christ. I want to present Jesus in a way that makes people hungry for it. So yeah, we have 600 plus kids, and probably a third of them at most are a part of our church. So I have more greater diversity in our school than our local public schools. There's waiting lists in numerous grades. I mean, the community is dying to get in here, and that's exciting.
That's terrific. And I have had the chance to visit your school once and saw, you know, I could see that somewhat. And I love the idea of being gospel driven throughout and not saying, okay, you're Christians, let's get in line here. That's good. So you've kind of pushed back gently on a question I wanted to ask you, and that is, or a comment I wanted to make. You feel a little bit like the Wendell Berry pastor that I know. He's, you know, he's writing these stories about Jaber Crow and so forth in this little town in Kentucky, and he just stays there with the land. And I wanted to paint you as a virtuous person, or at least wise or persevering or something. And honestly, I do want to elicit, if I can, a word from you to younger adults who are looking at their career at the early stages, and the path is very straightforward. The first place you work, you don't want to work there more than 2.5 years, because they're never going to take you seriously because you didn't know anything when you arrived. You've got to get in and get out. And if you can't get in and get out in your small town, go to another town. You'll find new friends. You'll find a new church. You'll find a new volleyball league. It's all going to be great. And then you do that again and again and again, and that's the way you climb. That is, even if you're self-deprecating about the rationale for your longevity, you do know a thing or two about it. You have lived a certain way. What would you say to the person who wants to climb and climb and is perfectly willing to switch jobs and switch locations every time a career opportunity comes up, or maybe even just a cooler city to live in?
Yeah, it's clear that God doesn't call everybody to Austin, Texas, or Nashville. right?
Exactly.
Yet everybody, every young person in America wants to go to one of those two places. There was fear in coming here because, like a lot of places, you fear whether your family will flourish. So, I mean, I was afraid. I was afraid that there wasn't adequate education here for my kids. I knew I couldn't stay. Starting a Christian school wasn't just missional for the community. I knew I couldn't stay, and I couldn't recruit people to work with me on the mission if we didn't start a school. I was afraid for, you know, even the culture of the community. You know, my oldest son, who spent more time in the local schools because we didn't get our school up and running to capture him. You know, when he went to college, he'd already had four kids he played ball with, went to school with, that were in prison for murder before he even went to, you know, I just thought, gosh, I'm gonna stunt my kids educationally. I'm going to stunt them culturally. I'm going to make them unable to live in big cities or world-class cities. And so, I mean, we actually had to do things to push against that.
So you went to Disney World, for example. That broadened their horizons, right?
It's
just, for the record,
world.
That's about 90 miles
it's
away.
It's a
from
small
Lake
world.
Canton.
We just ride it for hours. No, actually, the exact opposite is, so, you know, if you live in a small town, then you don't go to the beach and you don't go to the mountains for vacations. You go to cities. So we wanted to be in museums. We wanted our kids on subways every summer somewhere. We wanted them to be able to navigate cities and not be afraid. And so we had to be just somewhat intentional about stuff like that. Yeah, it's beautiful the way it worked out. With missions trips, even, you know, before my daughters were out of high school, you know, they'd been in Kenya. They'd been in the slums in Nairobi working as interns for the summer. And so I will just say it's amazing the way God has met us. You know, there is a sense of, I can't imagine anybody having a better story than mine.
But if you were standing in front of a 33-year-old who was going to move again, and you had 2 minutes before the food arrived and you had to go to your table, what would you say? You know, kind of like the, hey, you know, think about the comment you heard from Richard Watson. Think about letting your kids grow up in one place. What nugget or apothegm, if I can use that word, would you offer to people who are climbing the ladder, career and geographically?
Well, one caveat would be there are so many toxic churches and so many places where pastors are abused that in some cases I would say run for your life. So if anything I have a passion about, I think it's creating healthy culture in churches. If you can't do it there and you've really tried and God takes you somewhere else, and if nothing else, go start one yourself, because I think that's one of the great privileges is who gets to create the culture of the church that your kids grow up in. Bus drivers don't get that. Attorneys, doctors, school teachers, nobody else gets that. Yes. Pastors get to actually shape the experience that their kids have of Christianity growing up in a way that, well, you know, if that matters most, more than anything else, I want my kids. Now, I'm going to celebrate every person from Citrus County that walks through the gates of heaven, but I'm going to be looking over their shoulder at everyone to make, you know, looking for my kids coming behind them.
Right. You took my question plausibly as addressing a 33-year-old man who's in ministry. What would you say to a 33-year-old woman who is a sales manager or medical researcher? Same question, rise, climb, shift, move.
Yeah, well, I just think the what's going to guide your life decisions has to be what's going to bring glory of God, what's going to advance the kingdom. And, you know, the one who makes himself of no account is the one who finds life. So the one who's always seeking life loses it. You know, through the years, I've seen people make relocation decisions all the time, not pastors, but people in the church. And almost none of them say, I'm moving to Phoenix, I'm moving to Indianapolis, I'm moving because there's an astounding church there. In most cases, they haven't even investigated a
right.
church.
They just assume there'll be a good church.
Exactly. And that's a poor assumption to make.
Right.
Healthy churches are altogether too rare.
Mm-hmm. Let me switch gears. Politics. You do love politics. We're in a group that meets, and you're probably the theological leader when we turn to politics. So if you're not the theological leader, number one, you're at least 1A, and there might be a 1B and C. But I think you're a very careful observer of politics. How do you keep your church from becoming a Republican or Democratic church? How do you keep the Democrats and Republicans from getting angry at each other? How do you welcome people with a variety of social perspectives?
Well, I think we both know that it takes a lot more savvy than it used to take.
Yes.
And the polarization and the church is more warped than certainly in my experience. So, take the issue of race, for instance, I grew up with a deep passion about that. I always said Martin Luther and Martin Luther King Jr. were my two life heroes,
Right.
And I grew up just transfixed by the civil rights movement. I grew up with Cubans in Miami. I didn't grow up with many African Americans, but I got involved in Voice of Calvary and in Jackson, Mississippi, where I went to college. I went to Newark, New Jersey to work in the inner city right out of college. I mean, it was just a passion. Then I go end up in a little town in Florida where we have the smallest percentage African-American population of anywhere in the state per capita. So, started Martin Luther King Jr. worship services on MLK Day with the Black community and all this. And, I never really, the church loved it for the most part, until post George Floyd, really. So I realized that as we would try to wade into the cultural moment, especially in race in the last couple of years, is that there was a lot more resistance. I think the white community just got tired of getting beat up. And so I will just say it's taken a lot more patience and a lot more tenderness and a lot more going slow. And then I'm not realizing that you can, that there's a leading people. You can't drag people. And in much, in the same way that if we had a room full of college students who are very open to modern views on sexuality, and many of them gay, or many of them have gay friends, or many of them, that your posture and the way you're going to be very patient and very tender and very, so I say that's one thing. I just don't think in some of the issues in terms of politics, I think we also have, we've had to say, hey, there is every good reason to vote for Donald Trump, because that vote could represent a rejection of all the dangers of the far left that anybody should recognize. And there's every good reason to vote for Joe Biden, because that represents a rejection of the dangers of the far right that are very evident. So get off your high horse. That the gospel just doesn't allow self-righteousness.
Mm-hmm. Including political self-righteousness.
Yeah, and in our culture, if anything, somebody's got to model humility and loving each other. And please stop watching Fox News and CNBC. Please stop being catechized by angry people. Don't think that you can watch angry people all day long or read your Twitter feed all day long and that it isn't, you're not drinking, rat poison.
Right. I agree with you. That's well said.
It's actually been wildly liberating in this time. I've been really a diehard Republican a good bit of my life, to be honest. And, it was just great to be in a position to say, I can't in good conscience support either presidential candidate.
I try to keep this podcast neutral, but I voted for a third party candidate the last two elections, believe it or not, because I know not everybody views it this way, but I view a vote as an endorsement, not simply a hold your nose and choose the lesser evil. And I don't say that with pride. I say that with great sadness that I could not endorse on the last couple elections. I just lost half of my viewership, I realize.
Well, this has been a moment like that, where really that just that great freedom to remember that honestly, the kind of passion I felt about political has been misplaced. And it really is about the kingdom of God. And in that way, I'm sort of glad for being disabused of really some idolatry in my own life.
Let me shift us to my rapid fire questions.
Okay.
Rapid fire questions mean I talk fast and you do too.
Okay.
So you can't go more than 59 seconds, or we have a beeper. Somebody's holding a beeper. So this is the first one, super easy. Is it true that you preach 45 minutes?
No, usually longer.
52 minutes?
Somewhere between 45 and 52. Yeah.
Okay.
The clock in the back holds no sway over me.
Now, just a true or false, is it partly because you know that a lot of people don't come to church very often? This is your only chance to get a hold of them, get them in there?
No, because I love the sound of my own voice, and I'm undisciplined.
I disagree with you. I know you a little bit too well. Thank you for your self-deprecating manner. Do you love what you do?
I really do.
All right.
I love the church. I always loved the church when I was a kid. I find the job to be utterly overwhelming, but I love this place too.
What's the single best thing? What would you do for free for hours and hours? If
the single best thing about what I get to do is teamwork. Nothing thrills me more to drive away from Christmas Eve service and think of all the volunteers and all the people who sang and all the people who greeted and all the people who brought their friends and all. We did it all together, the team, everybody. I mean, it's like, what does a coach feel when he goes in the locker room after the game and everybody just jumps up and down? I love it. I love the teamwork.
That's terrific. What's the worst part of being a pastor? How do you take out the garbage? This has got to be less than 50 seconds.
It's still fear that I'll be exposed to the fraud I am, you know.
Yes.
Fear of my incompetence.
Yes. And it's a well-founded fear, to be honest. I mean, every time I get up to preach, I think, okay, everybody's going to know I have nothing to say. I've pulled the wool over their eyes all these years.
And I hate that there's dying, wounded sheep everywhere too.
Yeah,
and struggling, and I can't get to them.
What are you afraid of?
I have struggled with anxiety my whole ministry, so preaching is my greatest fear. Mm. Not the actual delivery, but
the blank
piece of paper on Thursday afternoon.
You know? Right. What would you like to be celebrating in 5 years?
I'd like to be celebrating having turned over this place to younger guys and seeing it thrive better under their leadership than it did under mine.
That's a blessed answer. What book changed your life enough that you would buy a bunch of copies and hand it out to people?
J.I. Packer's Knowing God. When I was a senior in college, I took a theology class and the professor assigned that. His name was Ralph Davis. And it wasn't just the book, but as he taught it, I remember his back to us writing on the board, and I would realize he'd stop writing because he was sobbing.
Mm.
And I think that's the first time I said, wow, this guy, he's owned by this.
Mm.
And I thought, if I'm going to do this, I want to do it like that.
What do you do to relax or play? What's your favorite pastime?
Grandkids, travel, sports.
That's three. I asked you for one. I know what it is.
Let me say my wife. She's going to listen to this. It really is. You know, I don't get a lot of time. My wife's paid a bigger price than anybody. And honestly, what's a better day off than my wife?
You know? There you go. That's a good answer. Put practical considerations aside. What would you do for 1 year?
Travel, you know, if I did have a, if I could do a job I want to do, I'd be a travel guide. And take people to see the stuff in the world that I've gotten to see.
That's terrific. All right, Ray, you've got one last moment to say what you want to say. You're a public speaker. What do you want to say? One last thing.
I would say to any pastor out there, the biggest mistake I see them make is when people make an adversary between being in ministry and their family.
Mm.
And they have those, I can't go into ministry to harm my family. And they have this idea that it's God and then family and then church. Well, that's ridiculous. It's Jesus. He's everything. And guess what? So is his church and so is your family. And so lead your family to be all about the mission. And that's been paid off in our lives. You know, our kids embrace Jesus, embrace his church. They're all involved. They're all on mission. And we lived in a little town in the middle of nowhere. They had a dad who didn't get the gospel for half of their childhood. And God's done the sweetest things in their lives.
That's beautiful. Thank you. Thanks, Ray. Thanks for taking the time tonight to be with us and to share your wisdom and some of your wit as well.
Thanks, Dan. It was a delight.
Thanks again to Ray for joining us today and being so candid. Ray sets us an example of deep, fruitful service in one place. People know I speak about faith and work, and a very common question they ask is, when is it time to change jobs? So in honor of Ray, and those of you who asked the same question, we're sharing a section from my book entitled Work That Makes a Difference. And this section is called Stay Unless Because. You might want to check it out. It describes when you should stay. There is a link in the show notes for this episode, or you can go directly to workingwithdan.org. At our website, you can explore archives of old episodes, subscribe to receive updates on new episodes, receive giveaways, and find bonus content. This podcast is a production of the Center for Faith and Work in partnership with the Alliance for Confessing Evangelicals. Please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And one more time, I'm Dan Doriani, reminding you to work hard, make a difference, and from time to time, take a break.